from Valparaiso, Indiana. For those of you that haven't been here until today, we're doing a series called Handling the Bible's Hatred, looking at stories in which someone seems, at least, to be pushed out away from the community or away from God into some outsider or enemy status, and we're trying to react to those texts. Were any of you at Second Breakfast? Mm-hmm. How did they announce the subtopic today? Anybody remember?
Odd one out.
Odd one out, they said? Okay. At First Breakfast, they announced it as one odd out. So, I was trying to understand the significance of that. Anyway, odd one out is the topic, and it comes from Luke 15, in which there seems to be, at the end of the prodigal son story, someone who's an insider and someone who's an outsider, and that's a story, it turns out, that's very typical of a whole bunch of other Old Testament stories in the somewhat similar way to what we saw yesterday in the betrothal stories, beginning with John 4. A bit of humor that will give you at least a slight clue as to where we will end up in this discussion. It's going to sound like it's got nothing to do with anything, however. It's a story about a preacher who delivered very stimulating and inspiring sermons, but he was still a bit of an annoyance to his congregation because he had the bad habit of bragging about the fact that he really didn't prepare his sermons, that he kind of just got up and spoke extemporaneously on whatever he happened to feel like talking about as the moment for the sermon came near. And his church council members became so weary of hearing him brag about this all the time that they challenged him finally one day and told him, all right, for this coming Sunday, you don't think about anything in preparation. We will pick the topic that you will preach on. But we won't give you the topic until the moment that you're ready to go into the pulpit. You know, you've bragged long enough about this ability of yours. We're going to put you to the test. So he said, okay, it's a deal. So they thought all week about a topic to give him, which would really represent a challenge to him. And they came up with a topic that they thought would do it. And so just at the point in the service that he's ready to walk into the pulpit, they handed him a folded sheet of paper. And he walked up into the pulpit and they sat down, smugly knowing that they really had this fellow this time. And they waited for him to make a fool of himself. And they watched as he got into the pulpit and he opened the piece of paper and there was one word on it. It said constipation. And much to the amazement of the church council in particular, he, without a moment's hesitation, opened his Bible and said, the text for today is from the book of Exodus, and Moses took the two tablets and went out into the wilderness. So that doesn't really relate to much right now, but maybe later on in the period you'll see why I told that. I want to begin this morning simply by taking a look together at this exceedingly familiar parable to most of us in Luke 15, known in most circles as the parable of the prodigal son, though it's come to be called lots of other things nowadays, the parable of the two sons. Some call it the parable of the prodigal father, and so forth. So let's try to read this as a collective group here, not like we did yesterday, because there's not quite enough dialogue, but taking turns, would somebody read the first two verses and then jump to verse 11, and every few verses would someone else take over. So would someone start, please, with verses 1 and 2.
Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them."
Verse 11.
And he said, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that falls to me.' And he divided his living between them.
Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property and loose living. And when he had spent everything, a great famine arose in the country, and he began to be in want.
So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out into his fields to feed swine. He would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, that I perish here with hunger? I will rise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.'
And he arose and came to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.'
But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly bring out a robe, the best one, put it on him, put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate.
For this son of mine was dead and is alive again, he was lost and is found,' and they began to celebrate.
Now his elder son was in the fields, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant.
He said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fat calf, because he has received him safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and greeted him. But he answered his father, 'Lo, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your commandment. Yet you never gave me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who was devoured your living with harlots and killed for him the fatted calf.'
And he said to him, 'Son, you were always with me, and all this that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'"
Okay, thank you. We've all heard that many times, I'm sure. Probably some of you have studied this in some detail. There are many things one can study about parables, including in a case like this, a nice case study in how parables work, you know, why they are so effective. One of the things that parables do, or any good story does actually, is to draw you inside somehow into the story so that you somehow or another identify with some character in the story and begin to look at what's going on from the perspective or from the eyes of that person, and oftentimes end up seeing things you hadn't noticed before because you're looking from a different angle, looking from a new person's eyes you hadn't shared before. All good parables do that. All good stories do that. Novels, soap operas, movies, everything that hooks you and gets you drawn in to want to know how this comes out does so by getting you to identify, to link yourself to somebody in the story. I suppose that's easiest to see in a very simple parable like the parable that Nathan tells to David when David has gotten Bathsheba pregnant, and he finally decides he must do away with Uriah and kills him and takes Bathsheba for his wife. And then Nathan comes to David and tells him this parable of the rich fellow who had hundreds and hundreds of animals in his herds and flocks, and when a guest came to him, instead of wanting to kill one of his own flocks to feed the guest, he goes over where his neighbor lives, who has one little sheep who he treats like a daughter, who eats from his table, lives in his house, even sleeps with him in his bosom, and it's like family to him. And the rich man goes and takes that animal and slays it to feed his guest. And when David hears the parable, David doesn't realize that what's happened to him is that he has been drawn in to look at his own behavior and to look at himself, actually, from the eyes of his victim. And so he says about that fellow in the parable, bring that one here, he is a son of death. That is, I'm going to have him slain for what he did. Because when he can see what he did from the perspective of his victim, he doesn't like what he sees. The way the story did that, of course, was by hooking you with all the feelings that you were brought to share with the man who loved that one little ewe lamb, who he treated like a daughter. And all of a sudden, all your tenderness is used to link you to that poor man with the one sheep. And you begin to see the story from his eyes, just like David did. Well, that's how these stories work. They hook you by getting hold of your insights. And the tricky thing about the prodigal son story is that there are several characters that it's plenty easy to get hooked by, to identify with. Most of us could probably identify in one way or another with at least three different folks here. The younger brother. Almost all of us have been through at least something in our life that leaves us feeling, you know, unworthy, hoping that maybe somehow we can have a place back among respected people. I'm feeling that way today, actually. I accidentally flushed a diaper down the toilet in my chalet last night. The plumber is not happy with me. So I am not worthy of much today. I suppose most of us as well, you know, have had experiences which would allow us to identify with that older brother. There have been times, you know, when we have done what was supposed to be done, and others who have been wasteful and even wanton in their conduct have ended up, you know, with everything that we have in one way or another. And it's just not fair. It's easy enough to identify with that. And then, of course, there is the father and all the feelings that he has that we can easily enough identify with. In some ways, that's the central piece of the whole parable. The eyes, if you will, that maybe the parable wants us most to be able to see from are the father's eyes. Because in the case, for example, of the young son, he wants to make this speech, but before he can ever even get his speech out, the father you know, he doesn't have to listen to these speeches. He reacts before he even hears the rationale. And Jesus says, while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. That's that biblical word which comes from the Hebrew through the Greek, which means to womb somebody. The biblical word for compassion is a plural form of the noun womb. In the Hebrew Bible, to have compassion on someone is to treat them as though they were once in your womb. And when you can remember them kicking around in there, and you have a tendency to treat folks that were in there with a certain kind of charity for the rest of their lives, because that's your flesh and blood. You loved them before you ever saw them. You know, so it's a motherly kind of love. Fathers can get in on it some. So the key to this parable in many ways is the fact that the son thought he had to go back and make an explanation and beg and so forth, but what he didn't realize is that the whole time he'd been gone, the father had been waiting, looking down the path. And finally here came the boy back, and when he sees him coming back with the eyes of compassion, he does not see the jerk who asked him for his inheritance because he couldn't wait for him to die. He saw the little boy that he had taught to walk on that road. And of course he couldn't do anything but run out there and meet him. So plenty of emotion from three different, of three different characters that we can easily enough link to and find our place in this parable. But what we're most interested in the series here is whether or not anybody in this parable gets pushed away rather than brought in. Does anything in your own response to this parable seem to do that, to create that kind of a dynamic? Is anybody getting written off or written out or pushed back in this story? Or have you ever heard it used for doing such?
Well, the older son wants to almost justify himself in the eyes of his father, and I've heard it used in a kind of a works righteousness way. This is an example of the trouble you get into if you try to justify yourself by works.
Okay. Yeah, there's plenty of commentary on this parable of that kind, that this is a classic example of someone who is willing to be included simply by grace without deserving any longer to be part of the family.
He makes up stories about his brother, too. It's from the older brother that you get the notion that he's whoring around.
Yeah.
Nothing in the story before that suggests that that's what he was doing. Since here he's living luxuriously, perhaps, but he, in his anger against his brother, kind of really adding details to the story, so to speak. So he's trying to push his brother away.
Okay.
But his father has never shown, evidently hasn't shown much appreciation for the one that stayed home and conformed. And he's feeling that being taken for granted all the time. And this sometimes happens with children, that the one that is no problem at all is the one that's just taken for granted. And you never tell them how much you appreciate that they haven't been in trouble. So I think the father's only the one.
Okay. So this son might have a reason, to a legitimate reason to be hurt.
He said, "You never did anything for me like this."
Okay.
He's also alienated from himself because he calls himself a slave. I've been working for you like a slave. Doesn't feel very good about himself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't appear to like his life very much. I'm a slave.
Well, if you never appreciate it, then you can talk.
Yeah, see, this is exactly what parables do. They hook that kind of stuff in us. You know, we wouldn't even notice that unless we'd been through at least a little bit of that.
You know, I think have to intellectualize before I can say, right, that's right, this is the right thing that happened. Because I remember reading the Sal paper about 3 weeks ago about a woman who had used a lot of drugs and drank and ran around and really enjoyed a wild time. And then when she got ready to reform, then she got a lot of money from the state. And I thought, gee, and here I am. I tried to, you know, I didn't get to have all those wild times. But then, exactly the way most people think would be different. That's the way I thought. And then after I got myself in control, I realized that I should be thinking.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, that's exactly the. Yeah, it's sort of like the prodigal gets special treatment for having screwed up. You know, here he goes and makes a total mess of everything, and what do? We throw a party. You know, outrageous. It's very common for commentaries on this text to pick up on the fact that the story does seem to be making a critique of the kinds of folks who are listed as the original audience of the parable in chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Pharisees and scribes. The bearers of the tradition of observing Torah carefully and preserving Torah and so forth, and they are generally said among the commentaries to be those at whom this parable is directed so as to make them uncomfortable about their position as older brothers in this story. And the older brother not looking too, this is not a winsome picture. Someone who can't rejoice over the homecoming of someone who we thought was gone from us. And this fellow can't even rejoice that his brother is back. Has he no heart? And so most commentaries do pick up on the sort of lack of compassion and generosity and forgiveness on the part of the older brother. It's also fairly common to run into commentaries which suggest that not only is this a parable, which means to make the simple point that forgiveness and generosity are appropriate and perhaps even to be valued at least as high as, maybe even more than, slavish faithfulness to the rules. But that maybe this is also an allegory in which the characters in the story stand for somebody in particular. And so it is exceedingly common among the commentaries in the history of study of Luke's Gospel to say that the younger brother represents newcomers, Gentiles, converted pagans, folks who have been hanging around with pigs and putting dead pig meat in their mouth, which is what Gentiles do, you know. No matter what the Torah says, that's what Gentiles do. They eat dead pig meat. Yeah. And the older brother represents not merely the faithful and the obedient, but the Jews. The most extreme version of that interpretation actually is among the very earliest interpretations of this parable, a sort of strange interpretation by a fellow named Martian, a Christian teacher of the second century who was eventually judged a heretic because of his relationship to folks in a movement known as Gnosticism, which has a strange relation in history to early Christianity. But in any case, Martian was among people who felt that it would be better off if Christianity purged itself of all vestiges of Jewish influence. And so Martian taught that Christians should totally leave behind or even denounce the entire Old Testament. And of the documents that eventually got into the New Testament, there wasn't a canon yet in the second century. It wasn't completed no consensus had come yet. But Martian thought that the documents that Christianity should claim as authoritative were only the Gospel of Luke and the letters of Paul. None of the other Gospels and no other literature, because it was all too Jewish. Only Luke was free enough of Judaism, and Paul's letters he tolerated. But Martian excised from his copy of Luke the parable of the prodigal son because of verse 31. He could not see that God could ever say about the Jews, because he thought that this parable referred to the Jews when talking about the older brother, God could never say, "Son, you are always with me. All that I have is yours."
Also, it's a 10:15. Pharisees also.
Yeah, so there's a clue that there's something in this parable that if you make that be the Jews, you've got a problem that we might have overlooked by making that leap too quickly. Because the relationship between the father and the older brother is not broken. All that the father has still belongs to the older brother. That's still intact. We're just having a party, okay?
He is accepting the younger brother.
He accepted him back. Yeah. But the
when he accepts him back, can he do nothing for him, do you think?
Well, I don't know. We have to be careful with parables. It's sort of like an analogy, you know, you can only push things so far. But by law, no, he couldn't. If this were a true story, by law, the father could not give the younger son any more. The older son had 2/3 of the family estate coming by law, period, and there was nothing that, no way to alter that. Yeah, that's very firmly fixed legislation in the Torah. You know, lots of ways. There are many ways that's protected as well. In Deuteronomy, there's even provision for what might happen if a man had 2 wives and one of them he loved and one of them he didn't. And the older of his 2 sons was the son of the wife he didn't love. And his favorite wife had the second son. If the man is tempted to give the birthright to the wife or to the son of the wife he loves, he cannot do that. He
what
must.
About Isaac?
Pardon?
What about Isaac, Jacob, and Esau?
Yeah, we're gonna look at those stories in a minute. There's a whole long bunch of reversals. You know.
I'm just wondering, the hurt that the older brother feels, perhaps because the younger brother didn't follow him. In his footsteps, his role modeling as an older brother. I wonder That could be a feeling that comes into it, and at the time, no money or material things can match that hurt.
Yeah. So you're going to add to that?
I have a problem with seeing the allegory of the younger brother being the Gentiles. And the reason for that is that there has been a relationship between father and son. He knows he has an inheritance coming. The Gentiles haven't had that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only way that allegory could be upheld is if you somehow or another assumed that once upon a time everybody was connected to God, and and one part of the human race has been off eating pigs for a while, and now they want to come back. Yeah. I guess I don't really think that it was meant to be an allegory, but it has been allegorized rather consistently in Christian history to say that the younger brother represents Gentiles, and the observant Jews are the older brother. Well, just to put a certain kind of slant on these stories, or to look at a story like this from a different angle, I thought we would do something like what we did yesterday and the day before, namely, think about some other stories in the tradition, namely in the Old Testament, that are at least somewhat like this and might help us see some other things in this story. There are tons of older brother, younger brother stories in the Bible, and many suggest that it is precisely because of all that legislation about this tremendous advantage that the Hebrew legislation accorded to the oldest brother, the firstborn son. You know, by law, the oldest brother got a double portion of the inheritance, and everybody else got what was left. And so, even if there was only one, if there was only one, you got a third, but there were more, you split up that last third. And that must not have seemed very fair to a lot of younger brothers.
Well, the British law, primogeniture, did the same thing after the
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of cultures inherited this kind of a thing. So it shouldn't surprise us, though, that there are all sorts of stories in the tradition in which that fixed, rigid, cultural and legal institution of the right of the firstborn is challenged and thrown over. And so you get a series of older brother, younger brother stories in which the younger brother comes out on top. Begins with the first two brothers who ever show up, Cain and Abel. Cain ends up the bad guy. Abel's not around to throw a party for. But in Jewish tradition, Abel became a heroic character, the first of all the martyrs whose blood was shed for the way he worshipped God and was given a prominent position in the history of martyrs. Yes?
I had a question about the inheritance. A girl would inherit, not
a... That's correct.
That's what I sort of assumed.
Yeah.
Got the drift.
Yeah.
Women were chattels.
Women were inherited.
Right.
Yeah, if a man died, his wives and daughters were inherited by his next of kin in some way or another.
So only female children. What would happen to them?
So their uncle too.
If there were only female children, yeah, I suppose things eventually fall to some male next of kin. Yeah.
And that's what happened in England. The estate would be to the nearest relative, no male relative, no matter how far.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our series of older brother, younger brother stories, we have Ishmael, of course, who's the firstborn to Abraham, but he doesn't get the family birthright. Isaac does. And there you have a case where the whole business about favorite wife comes into play. Then you have Esau and Jacob. Esau is the older, Jacob the younger. And all sorts of dubious goings-on go into the fact that Jacob gets the birthright and Esau is left the outsider. Another famous one is the children of Jacob. The person who should have got the birthright would have been Reuben, the firstborn. But he laid with his father's concubines and shamed himself, and his father discredited him. Then there was Simeon and Levi. The two of them shamed their father by conducting a massacre of some of the neighbors. So the father... Pardon me?
That could do it.
And it made dad look bad, so he wrote them out. And so the fourth child in line, Judah, becomes the heir. And another important one that all of these other stories are partly remembered in order to support this particular ascendancy happens with David's children. Now, that one's kind of complicated because we don't know how many children David had, because he had at least 70 wives. And so how many children he had is hard to tell, but we do know the names of some of the ones who should have stood in line for the throne, beginning with Absalom, who was a rebel and lost out. Amnon, who raped his half-sister Tamar and was murdered by Absalom. Then there was the first child born to David by Bathsheba. Remember what happened to him? God struck that child as punishment for what David had done. So from a Christian perspective, David had at least two of his progeny die for his sins. And then there was Adonijah, who was still around when David was on his deathbed, and since he was the oldest surviving child, decided that the kingdom should fall to him, and he was proclaimed king. But Bathsheba went to David and said, "You really like me best, don't you? Well, why don't you make Solomon king?" And David said, "Well, fine." So Solomon was made king, and the next thing you know, Adonijah ended up dead. And Solomon succeeds to the throne. So a whole series of prominent stories in which younger brothers get the birthright and older brothers somehow or another get discredited and shunted aside. Now Martian and others could have used that set of stories very well to say, see, this is God's way, if Martian had kept the Old Testament. This is God's way. God always seems to do this. The younger brother who really has no right ends up with the inheritance, and the older brother who really deserves to have the family heritage, those older brothers, you know, they're kind of jerks. They discredit themselves. It's sort of easy to just jump over them. But Martian didn't do that. But still, he couldn't stand the story of the prodigal son, even though he might have used it for his own purposes, because he saw something in that story that leaves the relationship of God and the Jews intact.
Would that other story, not a brother story, but a parallel story of the workers in the vineyard that received the same wages, even though they didn't work the same time?
Yeah, there's another story of at least somewhat outrageous inequity. The people who work all day in the heat of the day, all 11 or 12 hours, getting the same wages as the people who worked 1 hour. Yeah. Well, your story about the woman and the woman who got all the money from the state after living a wild life is that same kind of story. Well, there is another older brother, younger brother story I wanted us to focus on for a few minutes this morning that just kind of gives us a bit of pause about any older brother, younger brother, or older sibling, younger sibling stories, and any temptations we might have to decide who is the insider and who is the outsider here. And do we need to take the story and use it to put anybody in a category of outsider? And I'm going to cite this story because it's got so many similarities to Luke 15 that I've begun to wonder if the parallels are only coincidental. And that story is a story which has Moses and two tablets. It's Exodus 32. I really doubt that too many of you somehow or another were reminded this morning as we looked at the prodigal son of the story of the golden calf. But let's read this story now, and every few verses let's stop and see if we've noticed any little connections, any little reminders, any little details that are even remotely similar, and the cumulative effect of them may add up to something. So could we read Exodus 32 in the same way we did the parable? It's just people take a few verses each, and we'll stop every so often after each person quits and see if we've noticed any details. So would someone start, please?
When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold which are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me."
So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt."
Okay, let's pause just for a moment. We got any similar details at all yet?
Isn't Aaron the younger brother of Moses?
Okay, we got an older brother and a younger brother.
He screws up.
Yeah, and one of them's gone temporarily. And one of them screws up, while the other one at least seems to remain faithful. Any other details?
There's gold.
Okay, we got gold rings. At the end of Luke 15, we put on a golden ring. At the beginning of Exodus 32, we take off gold rings. At the end of Luke 15, we got a calf. At the beginning of Exodus 32, we have a calf. Which both of which will get eaten, by the way, or consumed at least. That, you know, not in the same ways, obviously.
I never understood before why Moses delayed coming down from the mountain until you told that story.
That's right. It's one of those things that takes a while. Yeah. they tell me that when you listen to the tapes of this, that you can't always hear what folks in the group say, and people have been asking if I wouldn't repeat the things that people say, but I'm starting to think now maybe it's for the best. Never mind. Where were we? Verse 4.
When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.
The Lord said unto Moses, "Go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made a molten calf and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt."
The Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, and my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. But of you I will make a great nation."
Okay, anything even remotely similar there?
Have a feast.
All right, we got a feast going on.
Corruption.
Yeah. If the father in the parable in Luke is sort of the God figure, we've got God acting in a little different manner than the father in the parable. Although the father may have had his moments of being angry somewhere along the line. Notice, though, also we have the question of inheritance brought up. "I'll do away with them, and you will inherit, you know, the place." Just keep going.
"But Moses besought the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does thy wrath burn hot against thy people, whom thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, With evil intent did he bring them forth, to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil against thy people."
"Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear by thine own self, and didst say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do to his people."
Okay, so in this case, the older brother talks God into being forgiving. Opposite of Luke 15, where the father tries to talk the older brother into being forgiving. And notice you also have this business of whose people are these? Who does the prodigal belong to? In Luke 15, the older brother says, "Your son." Comes back and look what you did. And the father says, "Your brother is back. We had to do this." Notice how Moses talks to God. "Your people, who you brought up from the land of Egypt." And we'll see that later on, when the tables get turned, God's going to say to Moses, "Your people, Moses, who you brought up from the land of Egypt." So, you know, we got that same thing going on. Nobody wants to own the prodigal. 15?
"And Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tables of the testimony in his hands, tables that were written on both sides, on the one side and on the other were they written. The tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, graven upon the tables."
When Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There's a noise of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear." And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancers, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tables out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain.
He took the calf that they had made, burned it with fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it.
Okay, notice there's another connection there. When does the real anger begin?
When
he hears the music and sees the dancing. That's right. Same as with Luke 15. When the older brother is coming in from the field, he hears music. What's this?
Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they are bent upon evil."
But he said to me, "It is gods which are going for us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And I said to them, "Whatever you who have gold, take it off." So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and there came off his
head. Did you ever notice that before? You know, I don't know where this thing came from. Jumped out. Sounds like lines I used as a kid, you know. Ever I got in trouble. I don't know how this happened. 25.
And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him.
And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword on his side and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp. And they slay every man his brother and every man his companion and every man his dog, his neighbor." And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. And Moses said, "Today you have ordained yourselves for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, that he may bestow a blessing upon you this day."
Strange, isn't it? Did you ever read that part of the story before? Moses talks God into forgiving the people, and so God does. And Moses goes down, gets mad, and starts a slaughter in punishment.
Who were the Levites? I don't know.
It's one of the tribal groups.
Well, why would they have come to Moses?
The Aaron's?
Yeah, they're the tribe. That's the tribe from which Aaron and Moses come. They become the priestly tribe. I don't know. I suppose you could also say they were into slaughter. Remember, it was Simeon and Levi that had slaughtered a bunch of the neighbors and. No, that's irrelevant. Yeah, it's a group especially loyal to Moses and Aaron, I guess, by kinship. But it is, you know, it is still the family of Israel. We're slaughtering relatives here, 3,000 at a time, because of this sin. We better finish up. Let's move on, verse 30.
On the next day, Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will not only forgive their sin, but if not, blot me out of the book that you have written." But the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. See, my angel shall go in front of you. Nevertheless, when the day comes for punishment, I will punish them for their sin.
Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made. Strange way that this story goes. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than I remembered in the Sunday school lessons that I had, where it was pretty much cut and dried. But everything was sort of okay again after they ground up the golden calf and the people had to drink it and moved on. We're getting close to being out of time, so I just want to point out a couple more similarities and maybe try to draw a parallel or two between the Luke story and the Exodus story and what the implications for reading these two stories next to each other might be. Moses, you know, it would be really hard to pick out who is the good guy and who is the bad guy among the brothers in the Exodus story, for sure. Moses really acts out all the unforgivingness of his anger about what's happened, what his little brother has done while he was off talking to God. And yet God could forgive it, though Moses couldn't. And somehow or another, by the end of the story, God's back to being upset again too, and is going to not only send a plague, but from this point on in Exodus, God doesn't travel in the camp anymore. From now on, God is outside. Moses, he'll talk to Moses. He won't talk to Aaron, talks to Moses. So the older brother is still the only one, you know, who actually can carry on conversation. But God waits outside. And notice that's exactly how the prodigal son story ends up. The story ends up with God outside talking with the older brother. The parable does not take us all back in. We're still outside talking with the older brother. And you know, the party might still be going on, but not everybody's there, including God. So maybe these two stories together would suggest to us that if anybody gets pushed out of the story and someone thinks that you can celebrate God's mercy, celebrate grace and forgiveness, while somebody has still been pushed out, that you can go on with the party if you want, but God's liable to be outside somewhere and you'll have a kind of shallow party.
God is still in the outside.
Yeah. Yeah. So the ultimate outsider here is God. But the older brother goes out to talk. Or God talks to the older brother. Well, that's a sort of a slightly disconcerting ending. You know, there's not a real clean conclusion to this like maybe there was yesterday or in some of the other stories. And so maybe what they said at first breakfast is a bit, you know, one odd out. maybe is best. I don't know. I'm still working through what the implications of all this might be, and if these two stories really do mean somehow to be read together. But I do think they give us some pause if, for example, we want to write the Pharisees or whoever we think the Pharisees today are in the world, write them out and say, well, you know, we can dump them now. So I think the juxtaposition at least urges some caution. There is no Bible study tomorrow of this particular kind. There is a Bible study in the form of the weekly text study on Sunday's lessons, which the preacher for the week will conduct, and I don't happen to know who's preaching Sunday, so I don't know who will do that, but that's what will take place here tomorrow. This week's series will conclude on Saturday morning at the usual times with a kind of it's called Miscellaneous Villains. And what I'm going to ask is that any of you who plan to be here on Saturday, think about whoever it is in the Bible that you don't like. Is there somebody in there that you enjoy hating? And let's see whether we can bring them in, or whether we indeed do need to keep them out there. And we'll kind of just have a free-for-all on Miscellaneous Enemies on Saturday. Okay?
Have you seen that recent book on the story of Tecumseh?